Welcome our next guest now, and it is the season to welcome him. Nigel Ritson estimates he's eaten more than 50,000 feijoas in his quest to find the perfect one. His fascination with the fruit started in the 1990s when he bought a tough piece of land in Takaka with the dream of growing something. Feijoas were one of the few trees that could survive the tough land. But simply growing feijoas in hordes wasn't enough for Nigel. He wanted to cultivate fruit with the best shape, colour, resilience, and most importantly, taste. Now he runs a breeding program at Foretaste Feijoa Fruit, which aims to grow varieties that could become popular with commercial growers. Nigel, welcome. I bet it's a beautiful day there today, is it?
Yes, it is. It's pretty perfect, this.
Calm after the storm. Yeah.
Still day, you know, and it's warming and
beautiful.
It's looking great.
Beautiful. Let's go back to the 90s. You bought this very tough piece of land. You were determined to grow something on it. What were you looking for at that stage? Where was life at?
Well, it was pretty at a pretty hard phase, really. My wife had left I had a little 2-year-old boy and a baby to look after, and I didn't want to live in the city or the town, and I wanted to move on to the land, and I wanted to be closer to nature, and that might sound funny to want to be in better contact with reality, but I think people in towns and in general really lose touch with themselves and the world around them. So I wanted to do that, and I knew about Golden Bay because I've been in the mountains here with the Wellington Botanical Society when I was a teenager, and numerous trips up the Cobb, over the tops, you know, swimming in tarns. I helped build Fenella Hut, actually, a memorial hut to Fenella Druce, who was lost on the and a terrible storm in the Mount Cook area. Yeah. I could go on and on, but I'll
stop. The Cobb is gorgeous. It's such a beautiful place. So you were opening a new chapter. You were probably grieving and in a bit of pain, and you bought this land and put a caravan on it. And then what was the plan from there? Right from the start, did you say, I want to grow something here?
Well, I'd actually come from the Wellington area, and I'd planned in advance in a way that I had pages and pages of papers. I'd been to the National Library in Wellington and researched fruit and nuts, and I was interested in growing unusual fruit and nuts. But when I got here, and it started raining, and I walked out and around on the land, and I was springing up and down like walking on stiff porridge, and I realized that it was most plants would drown. So I then really had to short my list down to a few plants that could survive wet roots. Feijoas can't actually really survive wet roots, but actually, how I got to the feijoa point was I met a local nurseryman living in the Bay at the time, who's since moved on, but he was at the Saturday morning market, and I bought a whole lot of fruit and nut trees for a home orchard, and invited him to come around for a paid session to evaluate my land and give me his assessment and recommendations. He said the apricots or feijoas, and he said feijoas would be the best because they're shallot rooted, and actually locals I talked to said, well, you know, you're making a mistake, this is not horticultural land, it's pakehi. But we made it work over the years.
How have you done that? Has it been about where you plant, about thinking how moisture progresses on the land? Did you think hard about where to plant?
Well, at the start, we sort of rushed into it because I'd contacted Roy Hart at who was working at ReWalker at the DSIR, was the then DSIR research station. I think it changed plant and food at some stage, but he said that was on the recommendation of the nursery man. He said, contact Roy Hart, they're ripping out all their fragile plants. And Roy was pretty upset because when I did contact him, because I guess it was his baby and the government stopped funding for it. So there was 600 plants to move onto the land. So he asked me to form rows. So had the hay mown off it. It was a pretty wild place. And then formed 20 rows and planted from the bottom of the top of the slope to the bottom at about, I think about 4 metre spacings I had at the time.
So help me out. Did you take the DSIR plants, or was he just keen for you to plant them because they were going from that site?
Well, both really. True, they were. I guess I don't know if the DSIR or officially what it was, but they were available, and they would have been destroyed if they didn't have anywhere to go.
I know that bit of land well. As an aside, Nigel, I used to holiday on it as a kid. When it was a plum orchard. It's now plant and research. I know it well in Brooklyn.
Okay.
So there's a little aside. So anyway, you've got this kind of impetus to get into your feijoas. And what were the early experiences? How successful were the early crops?
Well, the first 10 rows were open to start by Apollo crosses. And then a rows 11 to 20 were open pollinated. And I suppose I learned various things watching them grow and fruit over the first 5 years. I think they take a while to start fruiting. Many of the plants died in the lower third of the orchard. It was just too waterlogged. Or they kind of survived and just clung in there, but they were never fruitful. Rows 1 to 10, the Apollo Biable Star, had some quite nice tasting fruit. But over the years that I assessed them, I came to the conclusion, I suppose about year 6 or 7 or something like that, that I said to Roy, well, none of them was really superior to anything on the market, you know, now, which was hollow and unique and so on. I selected Wainaro from that one. I've never been thrilled with the flavour of Wainaro. It tastes pretty good, but it's very, very high production and smooth skin. You can eat the whole thing, including the skin. And as it turned out, it had it stores really well in the chiller compared to better than any of the ones I've tested that are available commercially. So that's a plus. On the other side of the orchard, from rows 11 to 20, there were some fantastic looking fruit, you know, bigger, rounder ones and so on, but nearly them all of them were horrible tasting. And in the end, I culled them all bar one plant, 1310, which I named Karamia, which you can actually buy. I don't get any royalties from it because I never applied for a plant variety. Right, I didn't think it was good enough for that. But it was a plant I used as a standard for many, many years and put in further plants, Brazilian crosses and the Sweet 616 range. Replanting the orchard. And I used it as a benchmark because it was a reliable producer of fairly large fruit. And,
you became quite fixated, didn't you? You know, there's the culling you'd do. You'd be brutal when you need to. But also you were counting them, you were weighing them every single day, you were labelling them with plant numbers and the date it had fallen off the tree. Did it become almost a bit of an obsession to try and find the perfect fruit?
Well, yeah, that is still the obsession. it's not just an obsession though. I can remember back in primary school, teachers saying, "Well, New Zealand's an export nation. We have to export to survive, you know." And it's on the basis of wool and meat, and more recently dairy. And I've never forgot that sort of stuff. You know, I look at New Zealand and think, here we are down the bottom of the world. We import all the stuff, you know, new electric cars, and people like all the luxuries, and it's just coming in from overseas, but we've got to pay for the stuff. So
you're looking for premium product from that perspective as well. And tell me a bit more about what's been involved. You've learnt so much about conditions and timing, and how radically different the fruit can taste. Can you give us some insight into that? I mean, the effect of drought, say, versus excess rainfall on a crop.
Well, that's probably quite a good place to start, is looking at the land itself. Because roughly one-third of the feijoas down the bottom were dying or really sick from root rot and just being constantly waterlogged, except during droughts, of course, which occur. I thought, well, if I put in a diagonal drain across the field, and so I just dug it by hand and then filled it with rocks because I couldn't afford any any field tiles or anything. But even that wasn't enough. And after the big first initial cull, I rang up Sully's company, and they came around, you know, earth moving experts, and talked about what we could do. And it ended up, they recommended a bulldozer driver come and actually drive up and down the rows, up and down the slope, you know, and form rows, like running the full length down the slope. And the guy was amazing, the big bulldozer, and he could tilt the blade, and he just formed all these rows in about 4 hours, and then went round the outside with his big ripper and went along the shelter belt lines and to bust roots there so the plants in the field wouldn't be invaded with roots. And that just made a substantial difference. It made it possible to plant the full slope, and the plants down the bottom behaved exactly as the plants up the top. And they, you know, if they weren't susceptible to root rot then, just through their own individual nature, genetic deficiency or whatever you like to call it, they pretty well all survive. I mean, there's still some that die. I make selections based on lots of criteria and mathematics and using spreadsheets and so on. And then you just have to watch them, and some simply don't make it. They just gradually get sicker, and some of them have died, which is in some cases quite upsetting, because there's one in particular I can think of that just tasted absolutely amazing, you know, a really good plant, except that it couldn't survive disease, you know. So that's the land, but we've sorted that. Droughts do occur, yeah. And I can remember one year thinking, oh, it's been so sunny, you know, the fruit's going to taste great, the bricks will be really up. But going out and taking samples and then discovering that, in fact, the opposite had happened. And then the fruit weren't sweet at all. And it sort of clicked. Of course, it's the old photosynthesis equation, you know. Chlorophyll and water and CO2 and stuff equals sugar production. If you don't have the sugar, if you don't have the water, you can't produce sugar. So that's pretty important. And, droughts are always a struggle. You know, I've increased the size of the irrigation three times because of several times I've basically pumped the whole pond out. And the feijoas, you've got to watch them. They can look really, really good and survive drought for a long time. And you know, the ground here cracks and cracks open and you can stick your thumb down the cracks, and when it does, you know you've got real trouble. Although it's Pākehā here, it does actually hold onto the water pretty well, and it can go on for a long time. It's not fast drying like a sandy soil.
Let's talk about it, because you've obviously got this amazing palate as well, like a good vintner, say. And you've made the comment that a good Fijoa is mind-bogglingly complex. What do you look for? You've got a scale, right? Zero's no way. Five is the best tasting. What do you look for?
Well, having tasted so many and having done taste tests with you know, locals back in 2002 to 2004, I learned from the testing done by locals that my taste was very, very similar to other people's, you know, that actually more than 80% of people agree on the taste of, so that I could trust myself. That was quite important. In general, you'd say Fijoas are far too acidic for most people's liking. So one of my objectives is to reduce the acidity, you know. And, of course, it's always been to get rid of the bad flavours. Some people can't stand Fijoas, and I can understand why. And many of the varieties that are out there in the market, that some of them have some pretty potent chemical flavours. Wintergreen is one of the common chemicals. Taste doesn't necessarily correlate with appearance or high production. In fact, it's probably the inverse. So the more fruit a plant puts out, generally the worse the flavour is. You know, some of the really high production plants have just kind of got watery, insipid flavours in the fruit. And I think that if you look at from an input-output kind of perspective, the plants gathering nutrients from the soil, you know, nutrients from the air, if you like, and water, and it's trying to create a package that will attract mammals and birds, so on, to come along and distribute its seed by eating and taking it away. Well, the more fruit the plant puts out, the more it's got to kind of spread out its what it's gathered in terms of nutrients to each fruit. So I think they just really struggle to metabolize and create the compounds within the fruit when they've got too many. So
there's such a science to this. There's such a science to it, Nigel. Can we talk about it as a business? Because you mentioned you didn't sort of patent, if that's the word, one variety. You've got some hugely successful and popular varieties. How's it evolved as a business? It's not just putting things in boxes by any means. You're working as a breeder. And with whom? Because just to your earlier observation about the need to earn income, and we're an exporting nation, I think I've also seen you say there needs to be cooperation in this industry going forward. So who is it that you work with and sell to, Nigel?
Well, the truth is I've had a lot of trouble with different nurseries, you know. In terms of getting a fair deal, I don't want to go on about that because it's a pretty negative experience, but it's been pretty brutal over decades. I work with Dirk Kettle's nursery now, who I've found are consistently decent people, you know, they're honest and trustworthy. In fact, we don't even have a contract. They just treat me well. They propagate the plants and then on sell them to garden shops. There haven't been any commercial growers approach me. I find it hard to believe that this has happened, but it has. I mean, if I take Waitui, which I did a lot of work on around 2000 and through to 2005 to, you know, weighing fruit individually, looking at the distribution of fruit sizes and consistency, and had done the taste testing with the locals. And it, I mean, it came up top score in terms of taste testing out of all varieties, including Apollo and Unique and you know, commercially available ones that I'd put in the taste trials with them. I mean, it was phenomenally productive. It would probably produce roughly twice the output per tree that plants like Apollo would. And it had a far higher percentage of, this is going back because I haven't measured it, you know, since, a far higher percentage of high weight fruit. So there would have been very little rejects. I've put it at less than 20% would need to go to juicing, or juicing, you know, almost the great majority would have been, could have been premium fruit. And because it was so early, and producing just kilograms of fruit per tree, well, tens of kilograms before any other varieties on the market, I thought the commercial growers will love this because it'll make them a killing. You know, they'll just take out the market with the high production, the better flavors and so on. But look, they haven't taken it up at all. None of them wanted to step up and buy 2,000 plants.
Hey. Nigel, what would you recommend to a beginner, Nigel? Because I'm not a Feijoa fan at all. That chemical flavour you talk about and the sort of an odour that I don't get. So where should someone like me, from your years of experience, where should someone like me give it another go? What one should I try?
Well, I think if you know, the commercial growers were growing Waitui and Kawatiri, and you would like those, you know. Because I've given fruit to people who just say they hate fruit jars and then they can eat my good ones.
There you go. I'll give it a go. Lovely talking to you.
Okay.
What were you going to say? I'll probably what?
Well, I've probably got 20 new varieties in my orchard that you'd probably love, to be quite honest. You know, because they don't taste anything like the Feijoas you know, and the Feijoas, you know, they're different.
I'll explore. I don't know if I'll ever get to 50,000 of them, but I'll explore. Thank you so much and congratulations. Nigel Ritson, Breeding Program Head at Four Taste Feijoa Fruit.